Morning, everyone. Today we are beginning the sequence of two lectures. And the purpose of these two lectures is to look at the empirical evidence behind incentives. So we've done, I think, three lectures on the theory of incentives. We've done two lectures on the theory and some practical implications. Applications of performance measurement, which is of course crucial to the business of practicing incentives. And during the lecture today and the lecture next week, we will be looking at the available empirical evidence, which demonstrates a few things. So first of all, this evidence demonstrates that incentives work, right? So incentives work. Incentives do really in practice lead to changes in worker behavior, and oftentimes incentives lead to changes to changes for the better. So you sell more, you become more productive, you require less supervision to administer the same function. So the role of incentives in the real economy is generally positive. So that's one thing we're going to learn. The other big thing we're going to learn is about how incentives work. So what exactly is happening to people, to their motivation, to the effort they choose to exert, and to the composition of the workforce that the managers choose to have in their firms that delivers the outcomes that are statistically linked to the practice of incentives. So that's the second big learning outcome for today and next week. Now, last but not least, we're going to learn about the not so good effects of incentives, the not so positive effects of incentives on the performance of organizations. In particular, we will be learning about we will learn that incentives can be too much, incentives can be too strong, and that incentives can lead to so-called dysfunctional behavioral responses such as sabotage and attempts to game the system to the advantage of the agent rather than organization. But this will be largely the material of the next lecture. So today we're going to look at the effects of incentives on organizational performance from empirical studies, and we will also try to look at the mechanisms that deliver the performance outcomes associated with incentives. Now, we will study more, we will study a lot more about incentives in the Personnel Economics 2 course in the summer semester, so stay tuned and check it out. Now, let's begin with the absolute classic of the literature on incentives, which is a very famous paper by Edward Lazier called Performance, Pay and Productivity. Please download this paper from the library. Please read it. It is part of the reading that you should do in preparation for this course to do well on the exam. It is a classical paper, which has, last time I checked, it had more than 2,500 citations. Just for comparison, the total number of citations for my work is about 400. So it's absolute very famous. Now, what makes it famous? It was one of the first. It wasn't the first paper to show the positive effect of incentives, but it was one of the first papers showing the positive effect of incentives in a semi-experimental environment, quasi-experimental environment. It was not really an experiment, but he could successfully defend the claim that the effect of incentives that we see in the data is as close to causal as one could practically have. It was also one of the few papers that actually features the organization whose data the authors have used. This is a Safe Light Glass Corporation, an otherwise not so famous firm in the United States. It's a mid-sized firm. It was featured in this paper and now in academia, and lots of students know about Safe Light Glass Corporation. So what they did, one of the core businesses that they had, that they practiced at the time, was installing wind screens on the car. So basically the frontal plastic glass piece that separates the driver and the environment is the windscreen, and they were installing windscreens on the car, and they were repairing also the broken windscreens. Mid-sized organization, which evolved, whose HR practices evolved during the period between 1994 and 1995, from paying their workers the hourly rate of, I think, $11 per hour, but I don't remember, to piece rate. So this was an organization that decided to shift from hourly pay, which is not related to output, to a pay that would be related to output. So they introduced a piece rate scheme, a very simple linear piece rate scheme that we studied in the theoretical part of the course. Now they're paying $20 not per hour or per sort of unit of time, which is only indirectly related to output, but to the output itself. And the output in this case was a unit, was basically one windscreen installed on a car. And workers who did it got $20. So what they did, they rolled it out from starting it first in the workplaces that were closer to the company's headquarters for various administrative reasons, and then with time they were rolling it out to workplaces farther and farther away from the company's headquarters. So this way they got the variation not only in the between the workplaces who did and did not practice incentive pay, but also the variation in the timing when the practice of incentive pay started in a particular workplace. And from this variation, they were able to identify statistically the effects of incentive pay on worker performance. And these effects in this study were quite strong and quite positive. So productivity went up. Basically the number of windscreens installed per worker hour. Productivity went up by 44%, half of which productivity increase was due to existing workers working harder, which is the incentive effect that we know from the incentive constraint in the theory lecture. Now, the other half of the productivity effect was not because the existing workers worked harder. This was because better quality, higher ability, lower cost of effort workers came, attracted by the incentive pay scheme practiced at Safe Glass, replacing the less productive, higher cost of effort workers who were repelled from working at Safe Light Glass Corporation because of the extra financial risk and stress that incentive schemes cause. Incentive piece rate incentive scheme does not give you fixed income. It gives you less income security, and if you think that you that effort is very expensive for you, or income insecurity is too painful for you to bear, you wouldn't want to work in this environment. You wouldn't want to work under this incentive scheme, so you'll go and look for some other job. This is the so-called sorting effect that we, I think, have not really touched upon yet. So how incentives work is part of today's lecture. There are two effects. There's incentive effect, as I said, workers, existing workers increasing their effort, and that generates half of the productivity effect of incentives in Lazier's study. Now, there's also this sorting effect, which comes around through better workers, more productive workers replacing the less productive workers, because the more productive workers would be attracted by the possibility to earn a lot of cash, whereas the less productive workers would be repelled by the extra stress and income insecurity that this incentive scheme brings. Now, the interesting empirical question is, how do you estimate the incentive and sorting effects? Now, so that's how you estimate the incentive and sorting effects. You estimate them from the different variations of the following very basic regression equation. So you regress the log of productivity. Now, it doesn't have to be log, but using logs as dependent variables have advantages that you can learn more about from the econometrics courses. So you regress log productivity on a bunch of controls, because of course productivity depends not only on incentives, but also on the characteristics of the workers, characteristics of the time at which this productivity is recorded, characteristics of the workplace, all of which characteristics are controlled by the use of the appropriate control variables. Now, the variable, the most interesting variable in this regression equation, of course, is the dummy variable I, which takes the value of 1 if a particular worker works under incentive scheme in a particular period of time and 0 otherwise. Now, what is the total effect of incentives on worker productivity? The regression analysis shows us that the total effect, the sum of the incentive and sorting effect, that is measured by the regression coefficient delta. Now, by virtue of having log labor productivity as the dependent variable, you can transform delta into, you know, exponential form, and then the exponent of data minus 1 times 100% is the percentage increase in productivity that incentives bring about. Okay, so, and as I said, delta was 0.36 in the regression analysis in the Lazier paper. Do check it out. Now, exponent of 0.36 minus 1 is 0.44. So that means that the effect of incentive pay and productivity was 44% higher productivity. Now, how do you estimate the incentive and sorting effects? Well, to estimate incentive and sorting effects separately, we have to understand the anatomy of these effects. Now, the key thing about the incentive effect is that the incentive effect is the increase in effort that, and it's an increase in effort that has been seen in the effort of given workers who worked both before and after the introduction of the incentive scheme. So, if you want to isolate incentive effect, you have to control for two things. You have to control for the population, for the sample of the workers who were observed both before and after the introduction of incentive pay scheme in a given workplace, and you have to control for their personal characteristics, such as aversion to effort, such as motivation, such as ability, etc., etc. Now, an excellent way and simple way to control for both the population of the workers before observed before and after the introduction of incentives and the personal characteristics of this population is to use what's known in statistics as the individual fixed effects. So what are these individual fixed effects? Those of you who studied econometrics have come across the fixed effects in the panel data regressions. Do read up on this. Do read up on this. And when and if you get to the master program in this university, do take a course in econometrics or indeed my course in quantitative methods of management research. Then you can learn a lot more about panel data regression. Now, assuming everybody is cool about fixed effects, if not, read about it on Wikipedia or in an econometrics textbook. The way to control for personal characteristics and the way to extract the measure of an individual worker increase associated with the introduction of incentives is to run the same regression as before, except that now, in addition to the usual controls, we add individual fixed effects. Now, individual fixed effects are very simply the worker-specific, individual-specific dummy variable. So if there are, say, 10 workers working at Safelite Glass Corporation, you need 9 dummy variables and the constant term to provide a particular fixed effect for each of the workers working at Safelite Glass Corporation. Now, from this equation that controls for worker-specific individual characteristics by means of worker-specific fixed effects, the coefficient gamma on the incentive dummy will give you the incentive effect, pure incentive effect, which is free from the further effects on total productivity, which are brought about by the changes in the worker in the composition of the workforce, because we limit the sample to the workers who were observed both before and after incentives were introduced, and we control for the personal characteristics of these workers. Now, in the paper in the Lazier paper, when you read it, you will see that the estimate of gamma implies a 22% increase in productivity because of the existing workers starting to work harder. Now, how do you estimate the sorting effect? The sorting effect, you don't really estimate it independently of the incentive effect. You take a shortcut and you estimate the sorting effect basically as the difference between the total effect of incentives that you estimate from the baseline equation and the incentive effect of incentives that you estimate from the baseline equation augmented with the worker fixed effects. Now, of course, the estimation procedure requires an assumption that the incentive and sorting effects are additive to each other. This assumption may be worth testing, but if you know how, do talk to me. I don't know right now. Now, so these are the estimation results in Lazier. As you can see, this is the baseline specification, 0.368. Take the exponent of it, you get 44% higher productivity. This is your delta coefficient. It comes from this number. Now, what is gamma? Gamma is the coefficient from this specification, from specification 2. And what is so special about specification 2? The special thing about specification 2 are the worker-specific dummies, the worker-specific fixed effects that you need to include in order to isolate sorting effect from the incentive effect. Now, take the exponent of this, subtract 1, you get 22% higher productivity. The sorting effect is the difference between this and this, which is 22% higher productivity. Now, there were some other interesting results. The most interesting results, the most interesting of the results are two. The first is in the slide. The second should be on the slide, but it, for some reason, it's not on the slide. So please add it. Now, the two interesting results was that it was a win-win. Firms got higher. Firms got higher sales, workers got higher wages, but the increase in worker wages was substantial, but not higher than the increase in worker productivity. What it means is that, yes, you do pay higher wages to your workers. Incentives do require higher wages than fixed pay because of the participation constraint. But you also earn more, disproportionately more money extra because workers are working harder. Productivity went up by 44%. Wages went up by, let's say, 11%. The profit went up by about 30%, assuming all other factor inputs remain the same. And that's a massive increase in profit. Try matching that. This is actually quite high. And since then, most of the other empirical studies on the effects of incentives have failed to find such large effects of incentives. So it's not, you know, don't think that your profits will go up necessarily by 33% if you introduce incentives. They will go up, but not by quite as much. Now, the second very important effect was that you would think, let's go back to the first of the performance evaluation lectures. The first of the performance evaluation lectures was about the scientific principles of performance measurement, and then we were talking about the alignment principle, right? So what does the alignment principle say? The alignment principle says that you should reward the alignment principle say that you should reward performance indicators in proportion to the contribution that they make to the performance outcome of the firm. So if the firm cares both to the equal extent about sales as well as quality of the output that it produces, the workers should be rewarded to the equal extent for the sales that they deliver, that is the output that they produce, as well as the quality that this output demonstrates. right? So in the incentive scheme at SafeLight Glass Corporation, one of the potential problems could have been that, well, look, you are rewarded based on the number of windscreens that you install. Nobody cares about the quality of your work, right? So there could be compromises on quality because you're tired, the time is limited, you want to make as much money as possible, so you do not control quality as thoroughly as you would have done if incentives hadn't been so strong or if incentives were more aligned with the quality concerns. And therefore, the natural question is, given that the incentive scheme really prioritized sales and did not incentivize quality at all, what about the alignment principle? The alignment principle would predict that then people would compromise on quality and you would have more customer complaints after the introduction of the incentive pay scheme. This was not the case. And this is a very interesting finding. This was not the case. Why was it not the case? Then there is a long and largely verbal anecdotal explanation, which is interesting to read. The story was this, you see, if there are problems with quality, then the output could be directly traced to the worker who installed this particular windscreen. So if you had a complaint from the customer, you could see the number of the windscreen and you could track this number to the particular worker who did it, and that worker would then have to redo the installation without getting paid for it, because the workers were getting paid per unit, right? So rather than for something else. And that was, you know, an effective deterrent. Now, also, there was an element, of course, there was an element of people working in teams. So, for example, you know, if you didn't do a good job, your teammates could have to deal with the problem that you created, because, for instance, the customer came at the time when you were away, when you were on holiday or something. But then guess what happens when you're back? Then your teammates are really angry with you. So the peer pressure within teams and the possibility to control the origin of the faulty pieces and, you know, get the guilty workers to repair their faults prevented compromises on quality, right? So it's not that the alignment principle is not making sense. Rather, the story is that if you have a problem with the alignment principle, you could have some institutional checks and controls in place in order to try and reduce the incentives of the workers to compromise on quality. And this was successfully dealt with by this peer pressure in worker teams and not giving workers money for repairing the faulty windscreens that they caused. Now, our next chapter in this lecture will be about the topics of offering incentives to managers. So far, this classical paper was about offering incentives to the workers who create the output that the firm makes profit from. And that makes a lot of sense. This is well within the classical model of incentives. But you know, if you look at the empirics, you'll find that the likelihood of working under incentive pay and the amount of incentive pay as a fraction of your salary tends to increase with your position in the organizational hierarchy. So, put simply, if you are at the bottom of the hierarchy, if you're having an entry level job, then chances are you will not be getting incentives, and if you do get incentives, they will be quite small. But as you progress through the ranks in the organization, then the chance of you getting incentive pay will increase, and the amount of the incentive pay that you get will increase. So firms choose to incentivize managers who themselves do not necessarily produce the output that the firm sells. What they do is they control and monitor the workers who actually produce the output that firms sell. And the question then, the question then is, why do firms incentivize managers rather than workers? Why can't they just directly incentivize the workers, paying the managers, and I don't know, fixed rate for controlling and organizing the work of their subordinates? Why is it the other way around? And here's a paper that looks precisely at the issue of offering incentives to managers. Now, very interesting situation from the theoretical perspective. You do not incentivize the workers who create the output. You do incentivize the managers who observe these workers and can control these workers. Why do you incentivize the managers? Why don't you incentivize the workers? Well, the short answer to this question is that it's cheaper to incentivize managers than to incentivize workers. It's cheaper because the managers are fewer. And so, given the same incentive pay budget, given the same amount of money that you're prepared to commit to administering incentives, you can incentivize managers a lot more strongly than you can incentivize the workers. And of course, the stronger incentives are, the better it is, at least in theory. So you could spend the same incentive budget more effectively by incentivizing managers rather than incentivizing workers. Of course, the natural question which arises in connection to this statement is, well, but if you incentivize managers who themselves don't create any output, how will you generate these two valuable effects, the incentive and sorting effects that are attendant to the productivity gains that you observe after practicing incentives? In other words, if you incentivize the manager, what is he or she going to do in order to increase the effort of the workers who actually create the output that you profit from? And it turns out that managers can do a lot of things to their workers. In particular, the managers can target the workers selectively and spend more time supervising and organizing the activities of the workers who are relatively more productive. That's one thing that incentivized managers can and will do if they are incentivized. So if you happen to be a productive worker, expect much more attention and much more stress from the incentivized rather than unincentivized manager who manages you. Now, the second thing that incentivized managers can do is they can select workers into their teams with a view of maximizing the total or the average productivity of their teammates, right? So rather than relying on workers self-selecting into incentive pay schemes or self-selecting out of incentive pay schemes, which is the effect that we saw in Lazier's paper, rather than relying on sort of self-selection, you may want to enforce the positive selection of workers into firms that practice incentives by offering incentives to managers who will then make sure that the right workers are employed and the not-so-productive workers are not employed. So here's a paper by Oriana Bandiera, Ivan Barankai, and Imran Razul. These three people have written a lot of very interesting and influential papers in organizational economics, and this is, I think, the first or the second of the cycle of papers that they wrote on the subject. Now, the context in which they conducted their empirical research was a farm in Wales, in Britain, where they hired workers to pick strawberries. Right? So it's a UK fruit-picking company. And as many strawberry farms in the UK and I think elsewhere, this farm relies a lot on seasonal workers. And most of these seasonal workers were students from Eastern European countries where wages are lower and where lots of young people are eager to leave these places for pastures green, as it were. Now, these strawberry picking farms would have special programs to employ students during their summer holidays. The students would live on the farm. they would pick strawberries and they would earn a certain wage for doing this. So the workers are the basically seasonal workers and young students from elsewhere. This is the bottom layer of hierarchy. Then there were field managers, the leaders of the teams of these workers. They themselves were not students, they were not seasonal workers, they were the workers employed on a more permanent basis by the farm. And what they would do is they would select the workers to work on the field, and they would assign the workers who they selected to work on different fields of strawberries, and some of the workers they would assign to the tasks other than picking fruit, for example, arranging the crates or driving a tractor that creates strawberries and whatnot. Now, and on top of this organization was the chief operating officer who was the manager of the field managers, and the field managers were the managers of the fruit pickers. Now, there were always quite a lot of workers on the farm. So a student living on the farm did not have guaranteed employment on each day of their staying there. So it could be that the student would not be hired on that particular day and would be hired on another day. So this oversupply of workers gave the field managers the opportunity to select workers into the team, to select workers into employment, or just not select the worker, depending on their productivity. Now, what they did is they changed the compensation package that field managers received. They used to earn a fixed wage, and now they added to this fixed wage a bonus which would depend on the average productivity, on basically the number of kilograms of strawberries per worker hour observed in the teams that they managed. So the more productive your team is, the higher the bonus you get in the end. Now the workers received piece rate per kilogram of strawberries before and after the experiment. So they were all sort of also incentivized, but this paper is not about incentives to workers, this paper is about incentives to managers. Now look here what happened. This was the average productivity for the managers who received fixed wage, 8.4 kilograms per worker hour. This was the average productivity of the workers working for the managers who received performance bonus. And as you can see, there's a 2 kilogram per worker hour increase in productivity, which is not as high as in Lazier's study, but also quite massive, especially if you take into account that the workers are already sort of incentivized to pick as many strawberries as they can, because they would get piece rate. So this is the net, if this is the pure effect of in giving incentives to managers rather than to the workers. Now, what are the other effects? Well, another effect is that you didn't need as many workers. You didn't need as many workers to pick strawberries from a given field. So an average strawberry field would need 3.7 hours of work time to collect strawberries from when managers were not incentivized. Now the time spent on the same field to collect strawberries on it after managerial incentives were introduced went down. Why did it go down? Because obviously productivity went up. So given that the number of strawberries is the same, it's determined by the climate and the characteristics of the field. The faster you work, the less time you need to do this. Now the earnings per hour went slightly down. And the piece rate per kilogram went also down, because it was a sort of the price that they would, it was not fixed in the contract. Now, not so good for the workers, but very good for the managers and very good for the firm. Now, and you could see the same picture in the regression analysis for productivity. Basically, whatever you do, whatever specification you try, There is a very stable, robust effect of managerial incentives on worker productivity, which is 22%, about 20% higher worker productivity. Now, the more interesting story, of course, is what can you say about the targeting effect and the selection effect. Just to remind you, what is the targeting effect? The targeting effect is one of the two mechanisms that deliver the effect of managerial incentives on worker performance. The targeting effect is about managers spending more time supervising, controlling, organizing the activities of the workers who are more productive and who therefore can pick more strawberries per hour. The field managers were interacting with the workers on a daily basis. They knew that this particular person is working very hard, picking lots of strawberries, and that person is actually rather lazy, and that person is eating more strawberries than he picks. So I would leave the useless workers to their own devices because you can't really gain much from them. But I would make sure that the hard working workers would work even harder and would be employed more of the time and would be assigned to better fields and would spend less time doing things other than picking strawberries. So I would organize the work processes in such a way as to give more exposure to the productive activities of the work, or production activities of to the workers who are relatively more productive. So what we see on this picture, what we see is that workers who are in the higher quantiles in terms of productivity distribution, these are, for instance, the top 10% workers in the quantile 90 to 100. These are the next 10% of the workers on the productivity distribution, the next, etc. So these are the useless workers, and these are the relatively productive workers, right? So what you see is that if you measure the individual productivity of the worker depending on whether this worker is ex ante, before the incentives were introduced, productive or not productive, the less productive workers, if anything, their productivity went down. But their productivity wasn't very high to start with, so never mind these people. They're just useless and you don't bother with them. Now, the workers who are relatively more productive, their productivity went up to a significant extent. So, once again, we see on average a 22% higher productivity because of managerial incentives. But the effect of this incentive scheme is quite heterogeneous. The workers who were ex ante not so productive, their productivity went down or stayed the same. This is the confidence interval, so basically it's an statistically insignificant change in their productivity. But the super productive workers, whose productivity historically was very high, their productivity has become even higher. Why? Because the managers really started targeting them, assigning them to the more productive fields, making sure that they spend more time picking strawberries than doing some other things like fetching crates or driving the tractor, for instance. And it is the productivity increase from the already very high productive workers that delivered the average 22% higher productivity that we saw in the previous slide. So this is the evidence of the targeting effect. Why did these guys react more strongly to the managerial incentives? Because it was these guys who were targeted, who were actually, more heavily managed by the incentivized managers than these guys who are relatively useless. Now, what about selection effect? Now, selection effect is just like it's similar to the sorting effect in the Lazier paper. Let me just quickly remind you, the sorting effect in Lazier paper was that relatively more productive workers would by themselves choose to work under incentives, whereas the relatively unproductive workers, the workers with higher costs of effort, would voluntarily by themselves choose not to work under incentive scheme. Now, that was the story in Lazier. The story in Bandiera, Barrancay and Razul is slightly different from that. There is no self-selection. There is no self-selection. Everybody wants to work. because, you know, that's how they can make money, and that's basically the only thing you can do on the farm. So everybody comes to in the morning to some central location on the farm, but not everybody is picked for work on that particular day. So it's not you who decide whether to work under the scheme or not. It's your manager who decides whether you will be working on this day or not. So there are workers who were selected into working most of the time. So on almost every day they would be selected. There are workers who there were workers who were selected out. The workers who were selected out basically are the rest of the workers who picked strawberries. And there were also workers who were quote-unquote fired. They were not really fired, but they were never selected into picking strawberries. They may have been selected into, I don't know, other tasks on the farm, but not selected into picking strawberries. The selection effect, what would be the empirical marker of the selection effect in the data? The workers who were selected in would be most productive. Would be the workers who are the most productive, because you want, not only do you want to target the most productive workers, which is the story of the targeting effect, you also want to have the relatively more productive workers to start with. Now, the selected out workers will be less productive, and the workers who will never pick strawberries after the managerial bonus is introduced will be the least productive of the bunch. Now, look here what happens. These are the fired workers. Well, fixed or fired. I misread. It's fixed. I thought they were fired. Never mind. So, look here. Who are the workers who were selected to pick strawberries most of the time after the performance bonus was introduced? These were the workers whose productivity was already the highest of the three groups even before the managerial bonus was introduced. So managers knew which workers are more productive, which workers are less productive, and they would select in the workers who were relatively more productive even before the managerial bonus was introduced. Now, what happened to these guys after the managerial bonus was introduced? Well, after the managerial bonus was introduced, these guys have really excelled in picking strawberries. They were already quite productive, but they started picking even more strawberries after they were selected in. Whereas if you look at the selected out workers, they would still pick strawberries sometimes, not as often as the selected in workers, but sometimes. But see what happened to their productivity. Their productivity went down slightly. Not a very large decrease, probably statistically insignificant, but their productivity basically stagnated. Whether or not there is a managerial bonus or no managerial bonus, somehow it didn't register with their productivity. Why did it not register with their productivity? Because they were less productive to start with, and therefore the managers, even though they would sometimes select them to pick strawberries, they wouldn't bother supervising them. They wouldn't bother making sure that they work rather than have a smoke break or something. So that's why their individual productivity didn't really change much. But these people, these valuable high productivity workers, would not only be employed more often, when they were employed, they would pick a lot more strawberries than the rest. And of course, there are fixed workers who were the least productive, and they were so unproductive that they were never selected into picking strawberries after the performance bonus was introduced. Now, speaking of their employment, employment is basically the fraction of the days spent on the farm that these people were not selected to work. What we've seen a couple of slides before is that you don't need as much labor to pick a given number of strawberries, to give an amount of strawberries, right? Because the people who you select to work to pick strawberries are now so much more productive that you don't need as much workforce anymore. So If you look at the unemployment rates for all the workers, you will see that after the introduction of the managerial bonus, all worker groups experienced higher unemployment level, higher percentage of time that they were not selected to work, that they were not selected to work on the farm or on the field. So it's true for all worker groups. However, the increase in unemployment rate of the productive, very productive workers who were selected in is much lower than the increase in unemployment rate of the workers who were selected out and the workers who were fixed, who were not selected into picking strawberries. They would be idle about a third of the days after the managerial bonus was introduced. On the other two-thirds of the days, they would be employed in other tasks, in tasks other than picking strawberries. So even though unemployment rises for all groups, this rise in unemployment rate is very differential, and it is minimal for the selected in workers, and it's very high for the selected out and fixed workers. What do we learn from this? Is not only do managers target the relatively productive workers, they also make sure that these relatively more productive workers are selected into picking strawberries more of the time. So, more frequently. Now, what do we learn from this empirical piece? Well, we learn that the story of the mechanisms that deliver the positive performance effect of incentive pay is very similar to the story that Lazier is telling. So there are two effects. There is the selection effect and there's targeting effect. The targeting effect is so analogous in some sense to the incentive effect in Lazier's study. Basically, we're talking about people who were employed before and after the introduction of the incentive pay, but people who were employed in both periods would increase their effort, and that's what we saw in Bandiera, Baranca, and Rasul paper as well. People who were selected in increased their productivity to a larger extent than people who were selected out. Now, the selection effect is analogous to the sorting effect. The difference here is that workers in Lazier could self-select, whereas the workers in Bandiera, Baranca, and Rasul could not self-select. They were selected by managers rather than self-selected. Now, perhaps a more interesting thing that we learn from this paper is that, incentivizing managers rather than workers who directly create the output may actually be a good thing, right? And it's consistent with the observations that we take from the real world, which show that both the likelihood and the amount of bonuses increases as you progress through the hierarchical ranks. Now, why is giving bonus to managers why is it a better idea than giving incentives to the workers? Well, because you could concentrate incentives, given the budgetary limitations, you could concentrate incentives and spend them on fewer workers, thereby creating stronger incentives than those that you would have created if you had to dissipate the same incentive budget to pay bonuses to many, many rank-and-file workers. Incentivizing managers successfully requires that managers should have some tools to influence the productivity of their workers. This is crucial. If managers cannot influence the productivity of the workers, then you are basically throwing money on the wind. And what's even worse is that the managers themselves are not going to like it, because they would say, well, if we can't influence the effort of our workers, then you're basically incentivizing a totally stochastic lottery-style outcome. We don't like it because we are risk-averse, so pay us a higher wage as a compensation against the risk that we're bearing. That, of course, is totally unproductive. But this is not the case in Bandiera, Baranca, and Rasul, because we see that managers can do two very important things to the workers. They can increase the output of particular very productive workers. That's the targeting effect. And what they can also do is they can select more productive workers to work more and less productive workers to work less on the task for which they are incentivized. So offering incentives to managers is a good thing, but it requires that managers have certain abilities and levers to pull in order to influence the productivity of the workforce. Now, it could also be a good idea when you don't want to play with incentive pay in the highly regulated environment in which there are strong worker councils who typically are not really very enthusiastic about incentives because, of course, incentives create inequality in pay levels, which some workers may take issues with. Whereas inequality among managers and more senior employees is regarded as less problematic. So these are my reflections on the incentives to managers. So the next chapter that I'd like to cover in this lecture is a very peculiar incentive scheme that is called malus incentive scheme. Malus. So far, we were considering incentive schemes that would offer higher pay to workers if they increase their performance. So these are the, if you like, positively framed incentive schemes or bonus type incentive schemes. So bonus is the Latin word which has the root which means good, right? So it's good incentives in some linguistic sense, right? But the world of incentives is not limited to bonuses. There are also incentive schemes which are characterized as maluses. So let me give you an example. I will give you another example when we move to the empirical evidence behind the effect of malus. Incentive schemes that are based on malus rather than bonus are less frequent but are still present in the practice of personnel management. One example that I like to give is the incentive scheme that I have at the University of Constance. The incentive scheme that I have at the University of Constance is a malus-based incentive scheme. I get a certain very generous salary, but I get it for 3 years, and if I don't deliver certain performance outcomes, they're specified in my employment contract, if I don't deliver these performance outcomes within the 3 years after the appointment, then some of the Leistungsbezüge, some of the performance-based additions that are already incorporated in my wage, will be withdrawn, and effectively that would mean a wage that is 10% less than the one I'm earning today. Okay? Do you see the incentives here? Incentives are quite clear, right? Now the question is, why would you practice malus? Why wouldn't you just practice bonus? Why would you sometimes also practice malus? That's a very interesting question, and I think it has different answers. Different people have different answers to this question. But one answer that is quite substantiated theoretically and has some empirical appeal as well has to do with a psychological characteristic, a psychological quality that a lot of people share, namely the quality of aversion to loss. So you like the gain. You know, you like the idea that you may earn higher salary if you work harder. But you strongly dislike the idea of maybe earning lower if you work less hard. So let me give you a very stylized example that shows loss aversion. Now, how much would you work? How much would you give for a chance of winning 100 euros? So here's the initial point. The amount of money in your pocket is, let's say, 0 euros. And somebody's telling you, okay, how hard are you willing to work to get 100 euros? And you say, okay, I'm risk averse, therefore my utility function is concave, so that's my concave utility function. If I move from 0 to 100 euros, right, if I move from here to here, then the increase in my utility will be from here to here. And by the virtue of concavity of the utility function, right, the marginal increase in utility from 0 to 100 is not going to be quite as high as the increase in the income from 0 to 100. Because, you know, the marginal utility of money tends to go down. Right? And you can see it. You can see it in terms of the concavity of the utility function. Now, here's another question. So you would be willing to work for an extra 100 euros, but the amount of effort that you would be willing to give to get an extra 100 euros in your pocket would be moderate. Okay. Now, here's another question. Suppose you already have 100 euros in your pocket. Suppose you already have 100 euros in your pocket. How much would you be willing to sacrifice? How much would you be willing to, you know, spend or work or whatever? How much disutility would you be prepared to tolerate in order to prevent the loss of the 100 euros that you have? Now, look here. This is the losses domain. So this is your initial status quo. This is your initial point. You have 100 euros in your pocket. You stand to lose 100 euros. What is going to be the disutility? What is going to be the change in your utility from losing the 100 euros that you already have in your pocket? It's going to be massive, measured on this vertical scale. So compare this disutility from losing 100 euros with this utility from gaining 100 euros. And in this comparison, you will quickly see that the utility from gaining 100 euros is smaller than the utility from losing 100 euros. What this means? It means that you would be willing to spend more resources, more effort, more money to try and not lose the 100 euros that you have at the moment than you would be willing to spend trying to gain the 100 euros. This is the insight which is behind the prospect theory and in particular behind the notion of loss aversion, which was developed by Kahneman and Tversky. Have you heard of Kahneman and Tversky? Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky? So that's the Kahneman and Tversky story, right? So what is the implication? Well, the implication for incentives is quite clear. If you offer people a bonus, right? If you offer people a bonus, then the extra utility that they would get from this bonus is measured here in the gains domain. But if you offer people a malus, then the disutility from the malus is measured in the loss domain. And the utility from a bonus, the extra utility from a bonus is going to be lower than the disutility from the same amount of malus. Therefore, if you create an incentive scheme which is based on the malus, you would expect people to work harder than under the same incentive scheme framed in terms of the bonus. That's the story. So if you want to squeeze additional effort from the workers, you could try and frame incentives in terms of the malus rather than in terms of the bonus. That's what the theory predicts. And there is a very famous, influential article in Management Science by Tanjim Hossein and John List. A very famous John List is a very, very famous behavioral economist. I'm sure you've heard about him. Steve Levitt, the Freakonomics guy, heard about him. So List is a colleague of Levitt, also a very famous economist. So they wrote a paper where they did precisely this. They estimated the effects of two incentive schemes, one framed as the bonus, the other framed as the malus. Now, this was carried out in a Chinese firm called Van Leeder Group. It's a firm that manufactures electronics, some electrical devices, I don't know. Now, we are talking about July 2008 to January 2009, during which time they played around with incentive schemes in this organization. And in particular, they devised three treatments, three different ways to incentivize workers. Let's consider the most interesting two of them, and then we will consider the third one, which is not that interesting for our purposes. So, the punishment treatment is the malus incentive scheme. The workers who received the punishment treatment, they received a letter from the boss, and that letter said, guys, we have decided to increase your salary by 80 yuan, 80 renminbi. So congratulations on that. However, if your productivity falls below 400 units per hour, falls below the target, we will think twice about whether to give you this salary increase or not, and we will likely withdraw it. So enjoy your salary increase, but if you work not as hard, if your productivity goes below the target, we will withdraw this salary increase, and it's back to your previous low wage. Okay. Now, the workers who were randomly assigned into the reward treatment received a different letter from the boss. And the letter said, okay, if you work hard enough, if your productivity is above the target of 400 units per hour, then you will receive an additional increase in your salary of 80 yuan. Now, let's just reflect on these treatments and what they mean for the expected wages of the workers, and therefore for the incentive effects that these treatments would generate. There is no sorting effect because the workers would not move and the treatment was not very long. The treatment periods were not very long so as to have a lot of worker movement. So let's concentrate on the incentive effect. Now, if you work hard, you will get a salary that's 80 yuan higher than what you're getting, what you're currently getting. If you work less hard, then your salary will remain the same. Now, if you calculate let's calculate the expected bonus given the amount of effort that the worker will choose. Calculating the expected bonus in both of these treatments would quickly reveal that in terms of expected bonus per unit of effort, these treatments are completely equivalent. Basically, this treatment tells you, if you increase your effort, you get an additional money, an additional bonus. This treatment tells you, if you decrease your effort, you will get your additional bonus withdrawn. In terms of mathematical expectation, in terms of what it means for the marginal product of your effort, these treatments are the same. Okay? Now, if these treatments are the same in terms of the expected marginal product of effort, they should have the same incentive effect. And if they should have the same incentive effect, we would observe the same amount of performance gain coming from the workers in these treatments relative to the control, relative to the workers whose salary remained unchanged. However, if there is a loss aversion component to the punishment treatment, which is not there in the reward treatment, the presence of incentives caused by loss aversion would result in the workers working under this treatment working harder than those working under this treatment. And that's precisely what the authors find. Not everywhere, not for all the workers, but sometimes, oftentimes, and in rather important cases, they actually find a significant difference in the productivity, increase that was caused by the punishment treatment and by the reward treatment. Look here at the table showing the main result. Now, the treatments were carried out for the workers working individually as well as working as well as working in groups. The people working in groups were doing other jobs than people working individually. There were different specializations. There were different work characteristics. So, if you look at these results, then you see that when you add specific time fixed effects and specific and group specific fixed effects, if you basically fully control the factors that affect worker productivity under both reward and punishment treatment, then in specification 3 you see that the reward treatment, in specification 3 you see that the punishment treatment is generating an effort response which is higher than the effort response generated in the reward treatment. So people work about 10% harder in the punishment treatment, and people work about 9% harder in the reward treatment as compared to the control group that has its salary unchanged. The difference between these two treatment effects is to the tune of 1%. It's not a large difference, but the difference is significant. What it means is that the effect is 1% stronger and it is significantly statistically different between these two treatments. Where does this 1% extra productivity come from? This 1% extra productivity does not come from these people, the people in the punishment group, getting stronger incentives. The incentives have equal strength. The marginal product of effort is the same under both incentive schemes. Where does this 1% come from? This 1% extra productivity comes from the fact that the punishment treatment is stronger because of the loss aversion that it triggers, whereas the reward treatment does not have an appeal to loss aversion. People just, increase their effort trying to get more money. But the fact is that people are increasing effort even more in order to try not to lose the money that they already got given. So if the University of Constance would tell me, Nick, if you fulfill such and such performance outcomes in 3 years after your appointment, we will increase your salary by 10%. I would say, wow, cool. So let's try to do it. But now they're telling me, Nick, you already have it. But if you screw up, we will reduce your salary by 10%. Now, each day I come to work, I think about it, and I work extremely hard trying not to lose the 10% wage that I'm already enjoying. So I can quite relate personally to this story, but of course it doesn't matter whether I relate to this story or not. What matters a lot more is what we see in the data, and what we see in the data is a small but statistically significant and economically important 1% productivity increase, which is directly caused by loss aversion rather than incentives. So look here, look at the effects of the punishment and reward treatment for individuals. And what you see is that sometimes the punishment treatment is stronger than the reward treatment, other times the punishment treatment is less strong than the reward treatment, but looking at the significant differences statistics, you see that these differences is not significant. You see that in case of individual workers, the punishment and reward treatment result in basically the same incentive effect. So why is the loss aversion playing a role here, and why is it not playing a role here? Right. So, and that relates to the comment you made. You made earlier, and the comment is, well, maybe it's not just some quirky property of the utility function. Maybe it's enhanced by some social factors. And it turns out that there is something to this story, because look, these are groups of people, and these are individuals, right? So, if you work in a group, and if you don't work hard enough, And as a result of you not working hard enough, the whole group is going to miss its performance target, and everybody is going to get a wage which is 80 yuan less than they expected. Okay, so not only you, but also your group mates. Now, what's going to happen? They will really criticize you after this. They will put peer pressure on you. You don't want to be the weak link in the group, right? So everybody doesn't want to, nobody wants to be the weak link in the group. Everybody's afraid of negative peer pressure, of the social pressure that they would experience if they were found to be the weak link. So everybody is working super hard, and that generates this differential effect of punishment relative to the treatment, okay? Now, another story that the authors tell in the paper, which is broadly, you know, it broadly speaks to the point you raised. The story that they tell is, well, teams, the groups of workers, may actually play a role of a sort of echo chamber for the individual preferences. Individual preferences, including the loss aversion, may actually be magnified in groups as opposed to individual workers. So suppose that really, you know, there aren't so many loss-averse people. Suppose that most of the people are actually loss-neutral, which means that they would spend the same amount of effort trying to gain 80 yuan as trying not to lose 80 yuan. So suppose the majority of people are loss-neutral actually, right? But you have groups of workers in which one or two people are really super loss-averse. Now, these super loss-averse people will keep on trying to encourage the group members to work extra hard because they don't want to lose their 80 yuan. So groups can be actually echo chambers for voicing and expressing individual preferences in order to try and influence the performance of your group mates. Whereas if you look at individuals, assuming that most of the people are loss neutral, most of the workers in this one leader group are loss neutral, it's not surprising that among individuals you don't see big difference between the reward and punishment treatment because there's no echo chamber. Because their effort is influenced by their preferences, and if the average individual is quite loss neutral, then there should be no difference between the reward and punishment treatment, which is what we observed. If, however, the minority of loss-averse people can project their preferences and thereby influence the performance of their group mates in the group, then the effect of loss aversion of these people will be amplified, right? So there are two stories that can be told. First, teams can be echo chambers, which would amplify the effect of individual loss aversion. The second story is that in teams, you don't want to be the, you know, you don't want to be the weak link. You don't want to be the one who will fail to deliver high performance results. And so everybody is under additional pressure not to screw up. And that's that you know, this social pressure that exists in teams to perform may be behind the differential effect of the loss of the reward and punishment treatment in teams, but not significantly different effects of these treatments in case of individual workers. Now, there is a third story, not so interesting. The third story is that, maybe the preferences for loss aversion are influenced by some, are correlated with some demographic characteristics. It's known from some studies in psychology that men are relatively loss neutral. They are less loss averse, so they get freaked out less when they stand to lose something. Older men are even progressively more loss averse than younger men. So younger men, such as myself, really don't like to lose things, whereas if I got older and older, I would be, you know, more and more philosophical about winning or losing, and I would make less and less of a difference. The older men are relatively less loss averse. And since individual workers are mostly older men with longer tenure at Van Lieder Group, they are different from the groups of workers who are younger and more female, relatively more females in the female workers in the group, who would therefore experience a stronger loss aversion. Now, this story is interesting, but it's rather weak, actually, because they do not have individual measures of loss aversion. They have not managed to ask people about how loss averse they were. If such measures were available, then you could take this story further and examine how much of the difference between the treatment effects it explains of the groups and individual workers. So, interesting story. What's the effects last over time? What do we learn from it? Well, what we learn from it is that you don't need to spend extra money. The two incentive schemes are the same in terms of the expected costs and benefits. All you need to do is to hire someone who is good at writing in order to write an incentive contract that would that would bring loss aversion considerations into the to the picture. So you could get a 1% in particular in case of Van Lieder Group, you could get a 1% more productivity absolutely for free, just because you write the incentive contract in a way that brings loss aversion considerations to the fore. Now, it's best applied to teams of workers rather than individual workers. The result is weak, the result is nuanced. Should firms practice incentive schemes with malus? This paper and the loss aversion theory behind it suggests that firms should try to practice incentive pay schemes with a malus. But my take on what I see as incentive pay practices in firms suggests to me that malus incentives are not really practiced very widely. There may be reasons why they are not practiced very widely. People don't like malus incentive schemes. Especially, you know, if you are trying to devise incentive schemes in highly regulated institutional environments with strong worker councils and, strong presence of a strong need to make decisions collectively to satisfy all the stakeholders, which is, for example, the case in Germany. In Germany, the capitalism is a lot more socially nuanced than the nascent capitalism. In China, you may want to compromise on economic efficiency and to devise incentive schemes that would be more readily acceptable by workers and managers alike. But this empirical finding taken on its own certainly suggests that when you can, you may want to play around with incentives based on malus, because they are likely to bring you, under some circumstances, they are likely to bring you additional performance gains for no extra cost at all. So that's what I think is quite interesting about this paper. Now, we are approaching the end of this lecture. Let's summarize. We've learned today that incentives work. We've seen that incentives, however designed, in the three papers we've seen today, we're learning that incentives increase worker productivity. Surprise, surprise. Now, what is more interesting is that incentives increase worker productivity basically through two groups of effects. The first is the effect of incentives through which individual workers increase their individual effort compared to the effort that they chose to exert before incentives were practiced. This is the incentive effect in Lazier's study and the targeting effect in Bandiera, Baranca, and Rasul's study. Now, but the second mechanism that delivers superior performance through incentives is the mechanism that operates through changes in the workforce. This is the sorting effect in Lazier's study, whereby workers could self-select into or out of an incentive scheme. And this is the selection effect in Bandiera, Baranca, and Rasul, whereby managers rather than workers could select the more productive workers into working and could deselect the less productive workers and leave them outside, employ them less frequently. Now, it is so the two broad ways that through which incentives work is first increase in individual efforts of the existing employees, but there's a second, also very powerful and important mechanism, namely the sorting. And we've seen both these effects operating in the actual data. Now, the third thing we've learned in this lecture is that, framing seems to play a role. Not a major role, but still sometimes framing gives you an additional performance increase from the same equally costly incentive scheme. And this the additional performance increase, which comes from framing incentives in terms of malus rather than in terms of bonus, is based on the theory of loss aversion. It's one of the many applications of the loss aversion theory. And in the world of incentive, the application is that, well, you may want to try to devise incentives based on malus than incentives based on bonus if you want further performance increase from the same incentive scheme. Now, yes, this is theoretically a possibility. The fact that not many firms are actually practicing incentives based on malus suggests that there are complications and difficulties, practical difficulties in implementing these schemes. You should also consider the effect of these malus-based incentive schemes on the participation constraint. And yes, people are loss-averse, but if you have a strong incentive scheme designed with a malus in it, the workers will want, the more loss-averse workers will, of course, work harder under this incentive scheme, but also the more loss-averse workers are likely to require a higher compensation for the risk of the loss that they could incur as a result of this incentive scheme. And this was the theoretical point which remains, but is not really covered in the Hossein and List paper. Now, what we haven't learned, and this will be the topic of the lecture next week, is can incentives actually lead to worse performance? Or a variant of this question, can incentives be too strong for their own good? Can you actually can incentives actually lead to worse performance of individual workers as well as organizations? And the answer is yes, it can. Incentives can be too strong. And what's even worse is that incentives can lead to performance responses that you as a principal are not going to be very happy with. A lot of examples, studies, and theoretical reflections on this topic will be offered next week. Thanks for your attention. See you later.